Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Susan Boyle of the Education Policy Community, Stafford Palmieri.
Hi, Mike. Are you saying I live alone with my cats?
I was not referring to that at all. I was talking about your breakthrough role. Your come from nowhere rise to celebrity. That's what I mean.
I hope.
In fact, I understand that you have an editorial on this week's Education Gadfly. That's really what I was referring to.
Oh, okay.
So, Stafford, here's the question. So, Checker and I have been debating on the Flypaper blog whether or not America is in decline. Mr. Glass is totally empty Checker here, you know, seems to think that this is the fall of the Roman Empire we're witnessing right now. And I argue back that no, that's not fair. We've got all kinds of social indicators looking the right way. And then the whole Tiger Woods thing happens. And blows my argument out of the water.
Because Tiger Woods is so representative from of the typical American male.
I mean, look, we've had, you know, there's a decline in divorce. There's a decline in teenage pregnancies. There's this huge collapse in crime. And there's a lot of good things happening in this country. And yet, you know, right, when we see these role models messing up.
I would not call Tiger Woods my role model. But I don't know. I kind of agree with Checker in the sense that we're less likely to sacrifice what we want. Like, we're very much a consumer-oriented.
And how far back in our history do we have to go to the golden days when people were putting things off for the future?
Well,
I mean, I imagine that it happened, but
50
I don't...
50 years.
I mean, the 80s were this great age of, you know, the me generation and,
right.
You know, walls... You know,
well, I'm not talking, you know, the Puritans. I'm talking, you know, mid-20th century.
Let's get started, Janie, and play Pardon the Gadfly.
Social justice charter schools are flourishing in New York with names like Acorn High School for Social Justice, and presentations on such topics as, quote, how to use the history of the Black Panther Party to fuel an algebraic curriculum. Are these schools going too far, even to the point of political indoctrination? Or are they sensible, if politically charged, examples of the kind of autonomy charter schools are supposed to have?
Janie, was that a rhetorical question?
Possibly.
Why would you put Acorn in the name of your high school?
Well,
why?
This may have been a good idea a few years ago before that group became had such a high profile in the political world. But what do you think about this, Stafford? I mean, this is the charter schools are supposed to be free to innovate, try new things, let a thousand flowers bloom. What's wrong with this?
And I think there's two arguments here. One is that parents have the option to send their kids to any school they want to. If parents have a problem with curriculum, they can send their kids to another school. At the same time, the Black Panther Party is not an appropriate topic to fuel algebraic curriculum. So I'm gonna side with freedom of expression. I think these schools should be allowed to teach whatever they want. I hope parents don't agree with it and pull their kids out, but I don't think that we really have the right to say they can't teach it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a tough one. I mean, this is the balkanization of our school system. And at the same time, I think if we did some digging, we'd find out that plenty of schools, particularly urban schools, are already teaching this sort of stuff. And, you know, the school is just putting it, you know, on their building. They're saying it in bright letters that this is happening. You know, whereas I think you can find a lot of the sort of social justice stuff out there. And some of it's okay. I mean, you know, it's not bad. You know, certainly kids should be learning about these civil rights movements and the social justice movements and all of these kinds. They should be debating these kinds of issues. The question is, at what point is it indoctrination? And it's the same concern people have about religion in schools, that when you're talking about impressionable young people, are we giving them an opportunity to make decisions for themselves, or are they feeling pressured and indoctrinated? A perplexing question.
Indeed.
Which we may not resolve today. Okay, Janie, topic number two.
Time magazine has a current story on helicopter parents and the backlash against them. Are American parents too overbearing? And should their kids be set free like the anti-helicopter movement is hoping?
Is that what they call themselves?
Apparently.
They need
the anti-helicopter movement.
They need something better than that.
Yes, indeed. Indeed we do.
So, Stafford, some people have accused you of having helicopter parents. Is that right? I mean, you're, you know, young Gen Y.
Referring. Yes.
They will go unnamed.
Yes, it is true. One could accuse my parents of being helicopterish.
Though they never got involved when you applied for a job here at Fordham. I didn't
hear from
them. They did not weigh in.
They did not.
Yes, that's good. Though you do hear that sort of thing happening.
It's because the helicopteree trains the helicopter quite well.
Ah, so, I see. Yeah. There you go. So part of this is about, you know, we've heard this before. Oh, we've made playgrounds so safe that it's ridiculous. We never let kids take risks. We don't let them, you know, the peanut allergy fears make, you know, the kitchen super, super safe and boring, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. The question is, are kids going to grow up to be resilient, or are they being too pampered and they're not going to be able to stand on their own 2 feet?
Well, I think what we've got here is two extremes, neither of which are ideal. But any day of the week, I'd pick an over-parenting parent over an under-parenting parent. I think we suffer actually from too little involvement, especially with kids who need it the most. Mm-hmm. And though helicopter parents can make a child not learn self-sufficiency, definitely, I think the other extreme of having a kid mm-hmm. who doesn't have parents around at all is much worse.
Yeah, and from our school's perspective, I think on the whole, most teachers will say, yeah, they want parents absolutely. To be involved. If there's, you know, if they're getting annoying, if there's, you know, they're calling about every little grade or every little, mm-hmm. you know, then the question is, can the school kind of divert that energy into something more productive? Can you get the over-parenting parents to do things that will help the whole school and help all the kids? You know, the fundraisers that could help everybody, you know, getting involved in fixing up the school, putting political pressure on the school board to fix this and that at the school.
Indeed, I think that's a good solution.
Topic number three, Janie.
Texas continues to refuse to adopt the Common Core content standards, claiming suspicion towards the national initiative and the superiority of its own state standards. Does Governor Rick Perry have a good point, or is this simply pandering to the Texas far right in anticipation of a tough re-election campaign?
Pandering.
Both.
I'm going to say pandering.
So there's this great letter circulating that was from Robert Scott, the commissioner of the Texas Education Agency, writing to Senator John Cornyn, you know, arguing about how horrible this is that the administration has put so many points into the Race to the Top application around the Common Core standards. So basically, Texas, that really should be pretty well positioned to get a Race to the Top grant, otherwise may not get the grant because they're not signing up for the Common Core standards, how this is a federal takeover of our schools, is the, you know, end of life and liberty as we know it. He even quoted Ronald Reagan.
He did.
In this. And there are some points. Look, Texas just updated their standards. They put a lot of money into the effort, and they're coming up with new textbooks. And so they've put some investment into this. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows yet if the Common Core standards are going to be any good. So Texas has some points on the merit. And it is true that this feels like coercion, or at least a bribe. You know, on the other hand, Texas has no God-given right to get a piece of this pie. And, you know, Texas and Alaska are two of the only states that are not doing this. You notice that those are both big oil states. I mean, they have other revenue sources. They're not hurting as badly as other states are because of their energy resources. So, hey, you know, what's $200 or $300 million if you want to stand on your principles? And, oh, by the way, also create a great election wedge issue in Rick Perry's Texas versus Washington theme.
So are you just willing to give up on Alaska and Texas students? Just say they should, you know, have whatever standards they want and we'll just forget about them. That's it? That's it? Are you that heartless, Mike?
Am I that heartless? Look, maybe they'll come along someday. Maybe. But I think, so. Look, the other thing is these other 47 states that have signed on, what does that mean? They've signed on. They've said,
nothing.
Sure, we'll participate. That hasn't said they've actually adopt these things.
Right,
and maybe
exactly.
They shouldn't because they still could suck.
It's
we just
true.
Don't know yet.
We don't know.
But we here at Fordham will let you know one way or the other because we're tracking it. And you know who's doing that tracking, Stafford? It's Amber Winkler. Dun, 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 dun. She's here with the favorite part of our show.
I can hear my music. It's so
cool. Amber, everyone's favorite part of the show here.
How
Amber's Research Minute. Yeah, you know, Amber did lead the effort on evaluating the Common Core draft standards mm-hmm. and comparing them to NAEP, TIMSS, and PISA in our STARS right. by which to navigate.
Yes, report. We gave them B's. So we think that, you know, if they get really crappy after this, we're in trouble because mm-hmm. we already think they're okay.
Yeah, that's right. You go much lower than a B, we're not so excited, are we?
Right.
Woohoo! Let's adopt those Gentleman C Common Core standards. Hooray.
Yeah, right.
All right, Amber, what are we going to talk about today?
We are talking about another NBER study that's looking at the impact of NCLB on student achievement. This time we have economists Tom D. and Brian Jacob, who are using state-level NAEP data from 1992 to 2009. They divide states into two groups, those that already had school accountability policies in place prior to NCLB. Those folks were the control group, and those that did not, those states are the treatment group. Having accountability policies in place basically means that a state publicly reported school data and used sanctions. So the idea is that NCLB would represent less of a treatment in states that already had these accountability policies in place before it came along. They find that NCLB had a statistically positive impact on the average math performance of fourth graders and also at the top and lower achievement percentiles. They also saw improvements in eighth grade math, especially among our low achievers. But there was no evidence of a similar effect on reading achievement in either grade 4 or grade 8. The integrity of the entire study rests on whether the comparison group is a valid one. Dee and Jacob use a framework developed by other well-respected researchers, namely Eric Hanischek, and we have no reason to believe that they wrongly identified the states, but we need to keep in mind that there's always an element of subjectivity when you're making calls like these.
Wow.
Yes. That's 60 seconds.
So, pretty close. What does it mean if they're coding... Because you mentioned that they recoded some states.
They did.
So what does it mean for their findings?
Well, basically, they didn't just use, I think there were 25 states that Hanischek had coded a certain way, and they wanted to include more states. So they went and did their research and figured out, okay, what did this state do or what did this state do? And then they found out, I guess they didn't agree with a handful of states that Hanischek, how he'd coded it, because they, you know, read some more stuff or whatever. It just means that they... that there were some discrepancies between the two.
Yeah.
But I guess the bottom line for me was, you know, anybody can, you know, there's going to be some subjectivity in terms of, you know, is this really a sanction? Because they didn't go into a lot of detail about how they defined a sanction. And I know, you know, people have a valid claim to say, well, maybe they didn't code them right. But I don't have any reason to believe that any other researchers would have done a better job of coding them.
And we published a study by Tom Lovelace last year on how high achieving students have done in the NCLB era versus the 90s, and he relied on that same coding.
It was actually Susanna Loeb's coding. Three different researchers have done a coding for that.
In other
that.
Words, he relied on a different coding.
Yes. As I said. Still somebody else's
coding. I did read that report.
Coding, right. So, I mean, they're not trying to reinvent the wheel here.
All right. So
they're using Hanischek's criteria.
Yeah. But let me ask you this. But the basic assumption here is that the state accountability systems were similar enough to NCLB to serve as a control group, but most of those did not, I mean, all of them except for Texas, they didn't have disaggregation of data by subgroup. You know, a typical one would have said back in the 90s, you've got a school has to get, say, 70% of its kids to proficient or else it's labeled as a bad school. That could mean that, you know, you could get all the white kids to proficiency, none of the black kids, but if you don't have too many black kids, you'd be fine. You know, so there's some question.
Yeah, whether they're, you're saying
the incentives have changed,
is the assumption that they made correct, yeah.
But the reading thing is interesting, and I think here, you know, because we have seen some bump in fourth grade reading scores across the board in both of these kinds of states. And one argument could be that could be because of reading first, and those kinds of reforms under NCLB might have helped. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it wasn't the accountability maybe in reading that's having an impact, but it could be better instruction, focus on scientifically based stuff.
Yeah, I was scratching my head about that with the reading. I didn't have a good hypothesis for why we didn't see that here.
Yeah.
I mean, because reading first was K-3, we're looking at grade 4.
Right. Why you wouldn't see the same kind of bump.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, but if you're not seeing an impact, it means that it could be because the control states are doing just as well. Right. I mean, there's not a difference between what's happening in control states.
That's right. Because we know there was a lot of bleed over. That was a big problem, you know, with the reading first evaluation. They were saying, well, you know, all that bleed over just corrupted the control group.
All right. By the way, gotta love the National Bureau of Economic Research.
Oh, they are working hard, aren't they?
They've been pumping out education studies. My buddy over at the National Bureau was telling me that they have taken a new focus in education. It's very exciting.
Well, tell your buddy this. Could they make their papers available for free? Because it is ridiculous that you have
to
pay for them.
$5.
But no, I agree.
We at Education Next, we make our stuff available for free, and it's just as good as that NBER stuff.
Mm.
I say make the knowledge.
I will give education type of writing.
Make knowledge available to the people.
I will give Education Next props for its pictures.
You've
got much better.
Yes, that's true. Okay, Amber, what's the song?
All right, so this is a stretch, but we have Lose Yourself by Eminem because he says we have one shot to get it right. And I thought, did we get it right with NCLB?
The moment you own it, you better never let it go. You only get one shot, do not miss your chance to blow. This opportunity comes once in a lifetime. You better lose yourself in the music. The moment you own it, you better never let it go. You only get one shot, do not miss your chance to blow. This opportunity comes once in a lifetime.
It's a good song.
It is a good song. It was a good excuse to get in there, to be Eminem in there. It's a stretch.
It's a good movie, too.
Do you know my wife has a big crush on Eminem?
Really?
Yeah. Even with the non-bleached hair? With the new look?
I don't, that's a good, I don't know. This was really a few years ago. I think when that album came out that she was more into him.
My dad really likes Eminem in a platonic way.
Interesting.
Really likes to listen to him in the car.
Helicopter
and Macy
parent
Gray.
And Eminem
yes,
fan.
Indeed.
I didn't see that coming. Okay, everybody. It is time for Mickey to rate that reform. Mickey, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be back.
In your special Rate That Reform position, now that Stafford has slid over to the guest co-host chair. What are we rating this week?
Today, I'm very pleased to report what might be the very first A-plus reform of the year.
Wow. Wow.
All right. So
it
let me just
all the way to December to get that. Yeah.
I was waiting for this. I was so happy when I saw this.
I will reserve
on the
judgment.
Okay. So let me just cut to it. This is kind of long. So the bottom line is Spokane, Washington has implemented standards-based grading in most of its elementary schools, and the first report cards under the new system went out last week. Standards-based grading is two things. It's multidimensional and it's numerical. You take a subject like fourth grade math, and instead of getting letter grades, students get numerical grades, in this case from 1 to 4, but it's on a whole range of standards aligned with the state standards, including stuff like, you know, can do long division with 5-digit numbers, can translate a basic word problem into an equation. Schools can still issue, under the system, schools can still issue traditional letter grades, but in general, this is going to force them to have them align with these numerical standards-based grades. So I'm just really excited about this. To me, I hope that it spreads all throughout high school and to college too, for three main reasons. First, it puts a lot more teeth on standards. One of the critiques of state standards testing is that teachers don't necessarily have to pay attention to them unless those standards are also reflected in tests. But basically, this adds another dimension that forces teachers to basically stay on top of the standards. The second reason is it's also going to produce a lot of interesting numerical data about student performance. And I think we're going to ask interesting questions like, you know, how this, you know, do the way that teachers rate their students as performing according to these standards match up with how the tests tell them that they're performing according to standards, stuff like that. And then third of all, it requires report cards to be a lot more transparent, to actually mean something rather than the current system, which in which grading is generally very obscure, and it's difficult to tell what exactly an A versus a B means for a lot of different reasons.
Wow. That's That's a pretty good grade. Now, is that grade standards based? No, I mean, could you show me? I mean, it is a little ironic to give this reform a letter grade.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So I want to know, which is this a 1 or a 4?
No, one, it would definitely be a 1. 4 is bad.
Oh, 1 is good.
Okay. Yep.
Now, see, yeah. Not so that's not so transparent.
No, that's no. That is totally counterintuitive.
Yeah. Exactly.
I would also point out that this is completely dependent on whether or not the standards in Washington State are any good.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. And I actually was going to mention that, but I know it's going way over my time. Of course, this whole system depends on standards.
So here's what's tricky is that, you know, the traditional way of providing a grade, it's all based on points, right? I mean, you get so many points for how you do on this quiz or that assignment or, you know, for participating in class. And I understand that there's downsides to that, and that those assignments and things may not be linked to the standards. But there is a sense that the student knows, okay, I got to really ace this test if I want to get an A. So I wonder, like, how this works in terms of student incentives.
From my understanding, there are points not only separate subgrades, not only for how you meet the standards, but also for kind of traditional kind of measures like punctuality and effort. And I was curious about that, too. I mean, to what extent are incentives going to change if students, you know, aren't really sure exactly how doing well on a test is going to affect their overall report?
Well, isn't the point of homeworks and tests to evaluate whether or not kids are learning anything /
sure.
meeting standards?
Yeah. But I, you know, with the crappy standards we have in most states, I just don't know that they're going to be strong enough to rest all of this stuff on it. All right, everybody. That's all the time we've got. Until next time.
I'm Stafford Palmieri.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show at edexcellence.net. Signing off.